My guest in the studio today is part of Australian jazz aristocracy. Guitarist Tony Barnard was born and raised in Bondi, but has spent much of his life in the UK and has performed with the music's greats. He's performed in the most prestigious venues internationally. He's performed for royalty. He's performed for prime ministers. He's even performed for Hugh Grant. He's one of the few artists who has mastered the 21-string harp guitar, and he's released over 40 albums as a leader. Tony Barnard, welcome to Now's the Time.
Oh, thanks, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's so good to have you live here in the studio, Tony. Yeah. And as I mentioned off-air before, you're the first artist we've had in here since the pandemic. We've been doing phone interviews, but it's great to have the artist back right in front of me in the hot seat, and wonderful to have you as our guest.
Oh, fabulous.
First one.
Thank you very much.
And welcome back to Australia. As I mentioned, you've been out of the country in the UK for probably something like 25 years.
25 years, yeah.
Mid-90s, was it?
It was 95, August.
There you go.
The 19th.
Yeah.
But who's counting?
You gotta remember it clearly. But the obvious question, I suppose, is how do you find Australia now? Now, I know you've been back a few times in that period.
Oh, yeah.
But how does Australia resemble the country you left in 1995?
Interesting. Well, it's pretty much the same for me. I mean, the venues have changed. The music scene's changed a lot. But the people are just the same, warm and hilarious, and the roads are terrible. I can't work out the roads. There's all these new roads. But apart from that, everything's lovely.
Yeah.
I'm loving being back, you know, close to the beach, and because I was in London for a long time where the beach was a long way away, and when you went to the beach, it was covered in rocks. It's a pleasure just to have it down the road.
Yeah.
And my wife and girls.
And a proper beach with sand, yeah?
Oh, a proper beach with proper sand and waves.
And I guess the next most obvious question is, you would have had, you know, pretty much 8 or 9 awful months as an artist in the UK.
Yeah, there was nothing going on. I mean, lockdown is just released today in London. My friends in London, one of them posted pictures of him at the pub because it's the first time they've been to the pub in about a year. So, you know, it's bad. And some of the really top musicians over there were talking to me about maybe having to chuck it all in because, you know, you can't make too much money out of streaming gigs, which they're doing, just to keep their hands in. It's good to be back here, although the venues aren't many, but there's still plenty of jazz around Sydney and some great players, you know. And
that's right.
There's a ton of them that I haven't discovered yet, all the new young guys and that I've heard about that I've got to go and have a listen to and be terrified by.
That's right. There's a lot of talent that's come out of the conservatorium, and they tend to have to go in, sadly, have to go into teaching pretty much immediately to teach others. So it's this self-perpetuating
quite sad, because I grew up in, when I grew up in Sydney, there were gigs everywhere, you know, every second pub or bar or restaurant had a band in it of some kind, or a duo or a solo act, or, you know, down the rocks in particular. You know, you could go and there would be a blues band, and then just next door there'd be a rock band and a jazz band and a folk duo and a whatever. And you could just walk down the rocks and take, it was like a smorgasbord.
Yes.
So it was a great experience, you know, for a young musician to just go in and be able to check out bands like that. And the big name rock bands like Dragon and things like that, you could just walk into a pub and see them.
Mm.
It wasn't like now where you pay $120 or something to go and see someone.
Now, back in 2008, I asked your dad, Bob Barnard, how much practice he had to do to find that original improvising voice that he has on the cornet and on the trumpet. And he replied that he didn't have to practice because he was performing virtually every night, which is exactly what you're saying. But what about yourself, Tony? How much practice did you have to do coming up?
That's a good point. I used to practice classical guitar a lot when I was young, 11, 12, into my teens. I practiced like a maniac. You know, I used to practice before school, and I'd practice after school and drive my friends crazy. He'd come around and say, come on, let's go to the beach. And I'd be going, another hour. And they'd all sit patiently and wait for me. And no wonder they all hate me. No, I'm just kidding. And then later on, probably when I was 17, 18, I was doing a lot of gigs. I had like 5 residencies a week. And so the practice didn't go down as much as that. It was more learning new songs all the time,
mm-hmm.
which keeps your hand in all the time. And the more you play, you know, at a gig, that's practice in itself, you know.
That's right.
I know you don't think of it as that, but that's
It's probably the best type of practice.
Well, it is, because you're thinking on your feet with other musicians to play off. So, you know, it all happens in that split second, you know, the jazz improvising thing.
You have released, as I mentioned at the top, over 40 albums. You're really now in esteemed company as one of Australia's most accomplished jazz musicians. Tell us what it was like growing up as a Barnard. How early on did you realise that music was the logical way to go? And how did you choose the guitar?
Well, I chose the guitar, this is a good one, because I was at school and one of the teachers had guitars for $10 and it was 25 cents a lesson. And I thought, oh, this is good. But this is the 60s, so, you know, and it was the age of Aquarius and all the poppy rock stuff, which I was into. I was only a young kid. So I thought that'd be cool, and that's what started me off. But growing up in the Barnard household, there was always something going on. There was always music playing. If it wasn't jazz, it'd be classical. My mum loved listening to classical. But I remember one night waking up just to go to the loo or something in the middle of the night, and Buddy Rich is sitting on the couch. And I turned around and went, "Hey, you're Buddy Rich." And he went, "Someone's got to be." You know, I didn't even think about it. I just, you know, went and did what and went back to bed. And coming home one night, Turk Murphy is in the kitchen, giant of a man, Bobby Hackett. And that was just par for the course, really. You know, you'd come in and go, "Oh, who's this?" And be Kenny DeVerne and Lou Stein, and the jam would start up. And I remember Alan Geddes one time playing the straw boater with some brushes because there was no drums there. So, well, we had a piano. But it was that kind of a place. It was always music and entertainment. Oh, yeah, and they're all hilarious. You know, I always found musicians back then, they all liked to drink and they all liked to joke. And even my grandparents, because they had a band as well.
Yeah.
There was always music in my grandparents' place, and they liked to joke and a drink, you know. So that was always, it was just there, you know. Yeah. I didn't even think it was abnormal, you know, or strange to have music in the house all the time or famous people popping in. It was just part of my life.
Who are your influences on the guitar, and are they necessarily guitar players?
Not necessarily. My early ones, of course, were, you know, Barney Kessel, Joe Pass, Herb Ellis, who I still love, and I got to hang out with Barney a few times. Lots of piano players, and Keith Emerson from Emerson, Lake and Palmer, it was a prog rock band. Mm. I still love listening to that stuff because he was, you know, past it, anything, but he became a good friend of mine. Gosh, there's so many influences musically. Classical guitarists, you know, John Williams, Julian Bream, Sabicus, a flamenco guitarist. I guess some rock guitarists too, you know. I think Barney Kessel was one of my main kind of style things when I was starting out, although I never, ever learned a guitar solo. I'd always been taught that jazz was off spontaneous. I've since found out that some of the greats used to practice this. I'll ask people they'd record them. So that's how I just started improvising and hoping for the best, you know.
Well, that makes sense because your dad really doesn't sound like anyone on trumpet, really. And that's been widely acknowledged for many, many years.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody sounds like him and he doesn't sound like anybody.
No, he's a one-offer, right? Mm. I mean, it wasn't really until I'd gotten overseas that I realised how well-known he was, you know, from in America and all the European countries I'd play in. They'd say, "Oh, are you in relation to Bob?" And I go, "Yeah." Mm. And they go, "Oh, Bob Barnard," you know. And I go, "Oh, yeah, right."
Did you ever feel it was difficult to emerge from your father's shadow? Was there ever any unrealistic expectations upon you just because of the name?
Well, I remember I had a gig at the Rocks Push with my own band, and I remember I was pretty young, probably 18 or something, and some people came in, came up, had a listen to the band, he went, "He doesn't play like his father," and left. And I went, "Oh, that's not good." But
you didn't bring the trumpet that night?
That's a tough question. Because I played more mainstream than my father's music, I developed my own little scene and I just battled on and forged my way through that to try and get my own style. And occasionally when we'd work together, it was great fun, and, you know, I'd still love working with him, but he's put the trumpet down now. It's as he said, it's in its case, firmly under the bed. You know, I don't think I had to get out from his shadow. I just embraced it all, you know, because I knew a lot of the musicians and all his friends as well. So, and they were very supportive, you know, all those older musicians. So,
well, it sounds to me, and this is only really only what I've gleaned from sort of growing up listening to your dad and Len Barnard for that matter, that the Barnard family really is just a family that really loves music intensely, greatly. It's not as if you are pursuing it for a career. It's something that just sort of totally consumes you.
It's part of the fabric, I would say, you know, because I listen to, I've always got something music on, because I, when I'm not playing the guitar, say at home, or just generally, just general life, I go down to my shed and make stuff and just have music on constantly. And that could be anything from film soundtracks to, you know, strange world music to jazz to some classical stuff, depending on what mood I'm in. Because I like to, well, it's good to expand your mind, you know, and I'm open to most suggestions from people who say, why don't you listen to that? And I go, yeah, right. You know, so that's good for you too. Mm. And the harp guitar has been a catharsis.
Yes. Now tell us about the harp guitar. How did you sort of how did you find that? How did you discover that?
I've been aware of them for a long time, but then due to the gift of the internet, I found this guy called John Doane one time on YouTube, and he had a 21 string guitar and he played all this magical. It was just magical, and I thought, ooh, you know, I could do something with that. So about 5 years ago, I had one made for me in England by this excellent luthier, Steve Sedgwick, and did battle with that for about a year. And because I did classical guitar all my life and I've always kept that right-hand technique, I took a fair amount of practice. It's like playing three guitars at once. So, you know, I just developed that and it worked for me, and it's been a magical thing for me. It's such a full instrument, but they've been around for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Is that
in
right?
One form or another, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow. Even McAfee and Gibson guitar companies made them back in the turn of the 19th century. I just find it magical. It's certainly eye candy as well, because it's an unusual looking thing. Mm. Half the time you get half the audience will come up and say, what the hell is that thing?
Yeah. So, yeah. Let's talk about you as a composer now, especially in terms of your epic Australian Suite recordings. And I've often compared your style to that of the Australian legend John Sangster. Now, through the years in the UK, do you feel you were ever particularly sought out due to that utterly identifiable Australian approach that you exhibit in your composing and your compositions, and the obvious sense of humour that comes through in that as well?
Yeah, perhaps. Maybe not so much composition-wise, but certainly the Aussie thing stood me in good stead over there. And when I did write all those pieces for the Australian Suite, I got some of the best musicians in London to be on it, like the Ronnie Scott's guys that I work with, and they were all delighted. You know, they just went, whoa, this is good things. And there's a couple of pieces I'm not even on. And that's that John Sangster influence we were talking about off air. Because I just fancied writing something and just sitting back and watching other people play it and listening to what they did with it. And they did, you know, as far as I was concerned, it was fantastic, you know.
I wanted to sort of tease out a little bit more about John Sangster. It sounds to me that you indeed were greatly influenced by him. Tell us a little bit about his duck and his room up at the El Rocco. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, he used to babysit me and my sister when we were quite young, like eight years old or something. We'd be up on the roof terrace of his flat above the Rocco, and he used to crack me up. He had a duck called Feets McFeeters, and him and his partner would take it out for walks on a lead through the cross, you know. Like I spent, you know, a lot of time with him over the years, kind of grew up with him. And I remember we were wandering around Brisbane one time with my band, with the Choir Brothers. We wandered into the roughest of rough pubs. I don't know why. And there's Sangster sitting up the back saying, I've been waiting for you. He was one of those guys. But I was lucky enough to go to a lot of the sessions for the Lord of the Rings things because, you know, my father was on all of them. And I'd just go in and sit in the booth with him and Martin Benge and get into the chuckles because he had an infectious laugh. And he'd play stuff for me out of hours. He'd play me tracks such as The Great Battle, which was... I remember going in and he said, listen to this tone, every track on the album in one track. And he'd play them all together and he'd go, that's a great battle. And I'd go, wow, awesome. You know, it was like kind of almost original or fairly, you know, original recording techniques he came up with as well. So, but he influenced me a lot, I think, and his imagination and the sounds he used to get. Plus my father did a bunch of records with him Don Burrows, Dita Vogt and Len that Dave Dowitz wrote, the South Australian composer. And I love those albums because it was something different about just having the vibes instead of piano.
Were they released on the Swaggy? Now that you're back in Australia, what are your plans once this music scene does return to some normality?
I'm going to just get some more gigs and, you know, keep expanding what I'm doing. I've been doing a thing with Glenn Henrich's band, The Vibes Project, which celebrates 100 years of The Vibes. We did Lazy Bones a few weeks back. Hopefully there'll be more gigs coming up with that, and Alex Compton on the bass, and my own projects, of course, which will involve Casey Golden and the harp guitar, because the Casey's style and the harp guitar just seem to go together so well.
And you've released two albums in that format, haven't you?
Yes, although one's just a digital one.
Okay.
And we'll be recording again soon, and the digital album, the second one, will be put onto that album. So it'll be
a double.
Yeah, excellent. Hopefully. I live in hope.